everybody's got a different style. Everybody's got a different approach. Somebody asked me, what's the Church of Christ component to Tim Hawkins' hand raising? I know of three. There's the toe tappers, the knee slappers, and the hand clappers. That's it. That's all we do, right? There are some of us. I love to see people express themselves with arms stretched out. That's kind of foreign to us. If you've ever been in places where people kind of pour out in worship like that, I usually put my hands in my pocket and just sway. That's what I do. I just sway. Oh, worship should be a time when we come to God and we are excited about it. I think somewhere along the way, we got this idea that we should not enjoy worship. Now, hear me real clearly when I say it is okay, it is quite possible to enjoy worship without making that the focus of our worship. Listen to these quotes about worship. I think you'll get what I'm saying. This is from David Wells. He says, the church must give up self-cultivation for self-surrender, entertainment for worship, intuition for truth, slick marketing for authentic witness, success for faithfulness, power for humility. A God bought on cheap terms for the God who calls us to costly obedience. It must be willing to do God's business on God's terms. Another author, a guy by the name of Robert Capon, he says the most critical issue facing Christians is not abortion, pornography, the disintegration of the family, moral absolutes, MTV, drugs, racism, sexuality, or score prayer. The critical issue today is dullness. We've lost our astonishment. The good news is no longer good news. It's okay news. Christianity is no longer life-changing. Listen to this. It's life-enhancing. Jesus doesn't change people into wild-eyed radicals anymore. He changes them into nice people. One more very convicting quote. This one comes from Richard Foster. He says, to worship is to experience reality, to touch life. It's to know, to feel, to experience the resurrected Christ in the midst of gathered community. Worship is our response to the overtures of love from the heart of the Father. And for some of us, this is what we've missed. That while we've spent a year in homes and engaging across technology that I don't understand, we understand that that's a poor substitution for really getting out and getting in front of God. And so this morning, we're going to hear some things about worship that might be challenging to you, but we're going to do it with a story that, well, it's about as old as time. It's one of those Bible stories you hear a lot in Bible classes, and we've tilled this ground. And we're going to hopefully tell you a couple of new things that I discovered this week. I did not know this before studying this passage again, and I've preached this passage several times. Let's hear it together this morning. John chapter 4, starting in verse 4. Now we had to go through Samaria, so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon when a Samaritan woman came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" For Jews did not associate with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you've nothing to draw from the well, and the well is deep, and where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, and as did his sons and his livestock?" And Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water that I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And the woman said, "Sir, give me this water that I won't have to be thirsty and keep having to come here and draw water." And he told her, "Go call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you've said is quite true." Sir, the woman said, I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. And you Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they're the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers worship him in spirit and in truth. The woman said, I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, am he. It's a rich character in this story. This Samaritan woman at the well. And what we find out in digging deep into who she is, there's some important characteristics about her. Number one, she's a Samaritan. And you're saying, okay, what does that mean? It means that she's been on the other end of racism all of her life. Who were the Samaritans? They were people that actually came out of Israel. They were part of the northern tribes of Israel. And then in the Babylonian captivity of 720, they're carried off. And while they're there in Babylonia, they intermarry and they become a what we might refer to as a mixed race. You'll remember some very famous Jews that were taken into captivity, Azariah and Hananiah and Mishael and Belteshazzar. You remember them? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Daniel. Same situation. They find themselves hundreds of miles away from home in a culture in a land that's different. And some of them did not obey what God had said, which was to not intermarry. And so these Jews that stayed in Judea, they kept their bloodlines pure, and they took a lot of pride in tracing those blood. Does anybody get uncomfortable when I talk about pure racial bloodlines? This is the waters we're in this morning. Jews wanted nothing to do with Samaritans. They considered them dirty. They considered them less than. In fact, when they rebuilt the temple, they wouldn't let the Samaritans help. And so as they built rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem, the Samaritans went to Mount Gerizim, and they had a temple there. Well, being a Samaritan isn't the only strike against this woman. She's a woman. And that meant something very different in that time, in that place, in that land, in that culture than it means today. She lived in the ancient Middle East where men degraded women. And some of you are thinking, I don't know that they do much better now. Some men would not even speak to women in public, not even their wives or their daughters. Can you imagine? Pharisees got a name. They got a handle given to them. They were called the bruised and bleeding ones. I did not know this until this week. They were called the bruised and bleeding ones. Do you know why? Because if they saw a woman, they would close their eyes. And they often ran into doorposts. And can you imagine that they wore that as a badge of honor? She's a Samaritan. She's a woman. And she's at this well at a very interesting time. She's there in the middle of the day. You wouldn't go and draw water during that time. You would go early in the morning when it's cooler. And you'd have all of your chores to do. And you could water livestock. And you could prepare meals. But she's there at noon. She's there at noon because she's an outcast. She's been married to five men. Five times she's picked out the dress and picked the flowers and gotten the caterer. Five times she's set up house in a new place. Five times she's heard the door slam behind her as she's kicked out, rejected. And so she shows up at the well at noon. She doesn't want to hear the whispers. She doesn't want to feel the stares. She doesn't want to see the sideways glances. Just confused. She's at a place in her life where she's hurt and she's thrown out, and she meets Jesus. I wonder if you've ever gotten there. I wonder if you look at the life of this woman and you go, I know what that's like, where everything in life just seems to be loss after loss after loss, and I just want to come and I just want to be with Jesus. I want to cut through all the other stuff. And so she wanted to hear what he had to say about worship. But that's not the conversation Jesus wants to have, is it? Jesus says, oh, can I get something to drink? It's an odd question. How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? Samaria, she says. And here's the thing about Jesus. Write this down. Jesus is no ordinary Jew. He's a different kind of Jew. He doesn't play by Jewish rules. He does things like eats with sinners, heals on the Sabbath. Ooh. Doesn't fast when other people fast. And they give him a hard time about this. You're not following all these customs. You're not doing all the things that we do so that we look righteous to everybody. And Jesus says, if you knew that the bridegroom was here, then you'd be partying too. You'd be celebrating as well. A lot is made of this passage about how Jesus is even traveling through Samaria. Normally, Jews would not travel through Samaria. They make a big deal out of it. Maybe Jesus is traveling through there for this encounter that he knows this is going to happen. Here's something I found out in study this week. Jesus was a Galilean. Not only was he not an ordinary Jew, he was a less than Jew in some people's eyes because of where he was from, because of the accent that he had, because of the people he grew up around. He was born on the wrong side of the tracks, raised in the poor part of town. And so the Galileans would actually pass through Samaria where other Jews wouldn't because they felt maybe somewhat of a kinship. They had heard the same epithets hurled at them. They'd been called dogs. You might remember Nathanael when Philip comes to him and says, we found the Messiah. And that famous thing that Nathanael says, he says, can anything good come from Nazareth? Nazareth is a town in Galilee. And this just didn't sound right. That Messiah would come from the other side of the tracks, the poor side of town. Jesus was still ordinary Jew. So what this lady finds out is that Jesus is way more interested in her than he is the water. Men had treated her poorly her entire life. And she was right. Jesus was finally interested in her, in not what she had to offer and not what her body could give. And so Jesus turns the discussion to this living water. Worship can happen, church, whenever we are thirsty. That's worth writing down. Worship can happen whenever we're thirsty. I love talking with teaching this lesson to kids. And I remember one vacation Bible school, this is years ago. We said, why do you think the woman at the well went to the why do you think she went to the well? And you know, we were trying to get into the whole, you know, well, she was afraid of the other people. And some kid goes, I think she was thirsty. I'm like, yes, you nailed it, kid. You got it. She's thirsty, and so she comes to Jesus. She could have written these words from Psalm 42. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with my God? My tears have been my food night and day, day and night. And while people say to me all day long, where is your God? These things I remember as I pour out my soul, how I used to go to the house of God under the protection of the Mighty One with shouts of joy and praise among the festive throng. Why, my soul, are you downcast? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise Him, my Savior and my God. You got to be careful in this world with the used to's. You ever hear the used to language? You hear it a lot in churches. Well, when I was a kid, we used to go door knocking. And when I was a kid, we used to have the joy bus. And when I was a kid, we'd have gospel meetings. And people really cared about sharing the gospel. And when I was a kid, we used to sing for hours at a time. And we'd come to church four times a week. That language is hurtful in marriages. When we were dating, you used to write me sweet notes and leave me presents all the time. It's destructive personally. Well, I used to weigh a certain weight. I used to have more hair on the top of this head. This hair wasn't so white. I used to look different and feel different. used to is dangerous language. I think that woman at the well, she thinks about a time when she used to go and sit and be respected, when she used to be loved, and when she used to have a safe place to call home. So many of us come to church thirsty. We could rewrite those words of Psalm 42 and say it ourselves. I read that and I want to go get a drink of water when I read those words, because we hunger and thirst for God. Lynn Anderson, one of my favorite preachers, he wrote this some time ago. He said, I can hardly stand to go to church anymore. Not that I don't want to worship God or be around his people. It's just that everything sounds so positive. They sing bright songs, preach upbeat messages, and smile so much, and seem to ignore the pain that must be sitting in those pews. It makes me feel so outside of everything, so disconnected. For years, I advocated for praise team to help us lead us in worship, and I still do, of course, but lately I've been wondering if we don't also need some lament teams. Sunday after Sunday, people show up on our pews in some state of real lament. The Psalms know this. About 60% of them are Psalms of lament, but these are often ignored. We want the mood in our assemblies to be upbeat. And yet so many of us come parched, starving, hurting. We could say in the words of the psalmist, in a dry and weary land where is no water, my soul longs for you. Worship can happen when we're thirsty, but worship can also happen whenever we're truthful with God. Whenever we finally take off the mask and just say, this is who we are. Jesus facilitates that in this conversation, doesn't he? He asked this very loaded question, where's your husband? Did you go get your husband? It's not an innocuous question. I think Jesus knows. And she must have thought, well, there goes this conversation. Things were going so great up until now, and now we've got to get into my marital status. You ever felt that way? I wonder what would happen if I were honest about the things that I've done or the things that I said this week or the anger that I had or the way I lashed out at somebody when I shouldn't or what I was looking at online or fill in the blank. And this woman, she gathers up all of her courage and she says, I have no husband. Most honest thing that I think she says in this whole conversation, I have no husband. And that's when Jesus really lets her have it. He starts to yell at her and berate her and tell her how she has failed him and miserably failed God and how she'll never measure up. It's not what happens. I was just kidding. He simply says, what you've said is true. And Jesus does this amazing thing. He bridges this gap between spirit and truth, because he's going to tell her in a minute that if you're going to worship, you've got to worship in spirit and in truth. And the spirit that he wants is a spirit that's hungry and thirsty for God, a soul that aches for God. And then he says, but the truth of the matter, where you get spirit and truth, we've said so long that truth is what we read in the Bible and our doctrine must be true. And I'm not saying we need to abandon sound doctrine. I think what Jesus is saying here is if we're going to worship in spirit and in truth, then we're going to be honest with God. The words that he uses for spirit and truth, same word for when he says, what you have said is true. And so you can be a Jew or a Samaritan, you can be rich or poor, you can be white or black, you can be a man or a woman, you could come however you are, just as you are, as long as you come honestly before God. And while we might expect, like the rest of the world, when we really put it out there and we really bear our soul, that people are going to walk out, Jesus stays with us and he continues the conversation. And the worshipers that he's looking for aren't the ones who are dressed the best or look the best or have cleaned themselves up the best. They're ones who trust the best. And then this amazing thing happens. Worship happens when we're thirsty and when we're truthful, but it also happens when we're transformed. And if you want to know the rest of the story, I would encourage you to go home today and read the rest of the chapter. This woman doesn't have some nice personal experience with God and go home and feel good about herself and then decide to attend church three times a week. She doesn't do that. She goes and tells her neighbors, strangers, people who were mean to her, all about Jesus. And she says, you got to come. You got to, in fact, you need to come and see for yourself this man who told me everything about myself. And the story goes that these people come to Jesus and they say, it's not because of what you told us, it's because of what we've seen and heard. That's transformation. So there's this song by Matt Redman. And Matt Redman is one of the great hymn writers, I think, of our generation. Just great songs. You would know most of the songs that he's written. But he was employed at the church during the 90s as a worship leader. And there was just something off about worship. And the preacher pulled him aside and said, you know, we're just missing it. And they were one of those hand-raising churches. They were fog machines and full-on light boards. And I mean, it was something. And he said, it just all feels fake. It feels phony. It doesn't ring true. And so they started to study and preach on worship. And they said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to turn everything off. It's a fascinating story to read because they said, and then for 6 weeks, we worship unaccompanied. And I was like, ooh, talk to me in 60 years. You know, like we know. And they said the amazing thing that happened is that people came and in this stripped down, bared down place, they were able to be honest with God. And coming out of that, you know what Matt Redman wrote? When the music fades and all is stripped away, and I simply come, longing just to bring something that's of worth that will bless your heart. I'll give you more than a song. If a song itself is, because a song in itself is not what you've required. You search much deeper than this. Through the way things appear, you're looking into my heart. I'm coming back to the heart of worship, where it's what? All about you. I hope that's what you experienced this morning. I hope that when you get in front of the Lord, when we gather together, when you're in your living room watching this, that you hear the voice of God speak to you. As somebody who might sit down next to you at a well and offer you living water. That's what God offers us. Worship can be confusing. Sometimes we don't know what to do with our hands or how often we should come or what we should do. Or the next time you're confused about life, try following the example of this woman at the well. Listen to what Jesus says. Worship him in spirit and in truth. And may we all walk away transformed. Thank you so much for coming this morning. We'll have elders in the back to receive you for prayer requests. We'll also allow this time, if you want to be baptized into Christ, we'll do that. If you're at home watching this online, we're so glad that you're here and you've been faithful in continuing to do this. If you'd reach out to us, we'd love to know that you're watching. And let's stand and sing together. God bless.